from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper. You are Live from the Path.
And you're listening to Live from the Path, coming to you from the Pathway Studios here in Johnston proper. Listen, you're magnificent.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I was for all the peoples, including you, Boo.
Oh,
you've been part of it.
It's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Yeah. I was genuous. In.
Genuous?
Isn't the phrase disingenuous?
I think so.
So it would be ingenuous.
Yeah, but is it? But in is not. The prefix is.
Oh, so is a double negative prefix is disingenuous?
I'm not sure about that.
I don't know how to take this anymore. Just be genuine.
Yeah, I'll be genuous. Hey. Anyway, you're listening to Live from the Path. Here's what we got going on the program tonight. Big question roaming around in Ben's mind for the last couple weeks, which is, listen, this is not devolve into some sort of weird political discussion. Do not send us stuff on the Google Voice about your core political beliefs. I don't care. But. The question is, especially if you're like more conservatively leaning politically, if some of the really big things happen in the Trump administration that they're pointing to, I mean like significant reduction of like government services and spending and stuff like that. I mean changes from a health perspective. Maybe even some of the things where I think the cultural that this isn't even specific to the Trump administration, but I think culturally some of the tides are turning on like transgender stuff and how pervasive that is or how it's regulated by the government, stuff like that. And so if everything you wanted or you believe could happen from the Trump administration were to happen today, are you ready for the spiritual implications of that tomorrow?
Mm.
And so I'll talk through some examples that were running through my head, but the big caution that has been in my mind is that we have to be super cautious that things that may even to you or for the country feel like a victory come with spiritual consequences, come with work for the church. And I would say that's actually true regardless who the just one office. Anytime you have a significant shift in the country on things that can happen fast, especially if you've got both houses in the presidency, right?
Yeah.
Stuff can shift very quickly. There's always an impetus for spiritual work. And when it's not your victory, if you don't agree with it politically, you run the risk of you're like, okay, we got all kinds of work to do. But when you do agree with it politically, I think you run the risk of going, we won. And I'm telling you that spiritually, this no one won. It just has a context to how you think about what work lies ahead. And I do believe it will be more than perhaps what you're thinking, especially if you agree. And so I'll walk through those, but I want to talk about that.
Okay.
We can go through those things. Also, Boo's got a question on the Witch of Endor.
Yes.
Didn't we talk about this recently?
Maybe we did.
Okay.
If we did, I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, maybe it'll be easy because
yeah,
we've talked through it.
Yeah. I was reading through the last 15 chapters in Samuel because I was getting into the David story, and I sometimes skim past things, and I definitely skim past the bride price that David had to pay for Michal, his wife, or whatever her name was.
Oh, yeah.
And then I skim past the fact that there's a medium of Endor, and Saul is like, hey, you should tell me if the Lord's going to, you know, do this thing.
Yep.
And she's like, all right, I see a God walking towards me right now.
Yep.
She starts describing him, and he's like, wait a minute, that's no God, that's Samuel.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, Samuel's dead. Wait, what? And so that was kind of my question as we went through that. I was like, holy cats, I don't know how to take that. And okay. So I have to ask about that.
Okay. All right. We'll talk about that. Also, the surprising but not surprising heartbreak of leading people to Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I started doing a different ministry in the last like 5 weeks or so. And we started doing church out of our house. And it's been amazing. It's been such an awesome and rewarding thing for for even my wife and I, we weren't expecting the rewards that we've been getting over the last, you know, 5 weeks or so.
Yep.
But I tell you, I did not have any clue or was not prepared for the heart tax that hits you when somebody walks away.
Yeah.
It just hurts. And okay. I wasn't expecting that.
All right. We'll get some, we'd like to hear more about that. Get some insight maybe from Dan, who's been doing ministry for probably met many of these types of circumstances.
Many.
And we'll see what wisdom Daniel has for us.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Love it.
Also, we'll have some advice on Dear Life from the Path. And there's a couple of things. If it depends on how the conversations go. If we have time, one, I was at some homeschool basketball games over the weekend, and some of these mascots, it just feels like people aren't thinking through them very well. As an example, and our teams are called the Warriors, and at least one of the older logos is like a Roman centurion mask. And so I just... And I saw multiple teams who were called the Warriors, or even not the Warriors, like Soldiers or some other, I don't know, like warlike name that I'm not sure is quite going for what Jesus was after. But they're all using like a Roman soldier as the mascot. And I just cannot pull this together why they're behaving in this way. Like, it's just like we didn't think about it. And so I'm totally over-indexing on it. But then I was trying to think through, what is it? What do I think is okay? Like, what would be a good mascot?
Yeah. Why don't they just go ahead and be the demons?
Yeah, right, right.
The blue demons.
The holy blue demons.
The holy blue demons.
I don't... Anyway.
Oh, I'd love to see that team.
It just feels like we put like one thought into it instead of two. And two thoughts would go, you know what? Even if we wanted to be the Warriors, and again, these war names, I'm just aren't sure what we're after. But like, maybe not... The Roman centurion who, you know, helped crucify Jesus. Maybe that's not the image we're going for.
Yeah, but you don't understand. That basketball court is a battlefield.
Yes, that's, and it's, yeah, yeah. And that's the problem. I'm against that. I'm against it. Anyway, so we'll see if we get to that. And I think maybe this will carry into next week, but I saw somebody offering, this is going to put you off like right away because it did to me, like somebody offering a one-day spiritual training for like $1,500. I'm like, man,
oh boy.
But the premise I thought was interesting, and it, basically the question is that like is it just where it's just like all politics is local, are we doing ourselves a disservice by thinking of discipleship and influence as anything but local? I say that because it was a post. It's like a thing put on by a guy who's published, I don't know, like 25 books or something. He's a pastor. He's done all kinds of speaking. He's got all kinds of people that follow him on the social medias. And at least for the premise of the event that he's trying to get people to go to, the presumption, like he's basically going, it was all nothing. Like it didn't mean anything. It felt like it's all fake influence. The thing that makes a difference is you, your community, your families, that type of thing. And we've kind of touched on that before, yeah. But I think it's the question. It's probably worth hitting up again, especially as you just maybe some of the stuff that we're going to talk to in the political conversation.
Okay. Hey.
Yes.
Real quick.
Yep.
I think local fine dining is fake. You know how, like, we've got the fine dining restaurants that are, like, giant and all the places that spend, you know, $800 per dinner kind of thing?
Yeah.
I think those might be real because that's more art than it is, like, a legitimate meal that you're eating.
Yeah.
But I think if there's, like, an Applebee's of fine dining where it's, like, fine dining in the local neighborhood kind of thing, I think it's fake. And here's why. I went to a joint that I would classify as local fine dining in the last week and a half.
Yeah.
And they brought out a bowl of artisanal Chex Mix.
Oh.
And they set it on the table, and it was complimentary.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, oh, thank you. And as we were eating the Chex Mix, I found a garbanzo bean in it.
Oh.
And the reason I think it's fake is because I didn't know if I was too dumb to understand that their Chex Mix should have garbanzo beans in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or if I was smart enough to have realized that, like, no, this is a stupid premise that there should be a garbanzo bean in a Chex Mix. This is dumb.
Yeah.
And it was a dilemma. On whether or not I should even mention this and go, hey, there's a chance that there are rogue garbanzo beans in your Chex Mix.
You're talking like the kind you'd see in a salad bar, like a soft...
Yes, like a chickpea.
Like
it belonged in another salad, but it was a cold, mushy chickpea in the Chex Mix.
Chex Mix.
And I realized that I'm not dumb. And so I made the comment and I went, hey, Just a heads up.
I'm guessing a mouse dropped.
I think your fancy artisanal Chex Mix has garbanzo beans in it. Is that an intentional thing? Because if so, weird. And if it's not an intentional thing, check your Chex Mix. I think there might be chickpeas in the
Maybe deal. That's their distinction. That,
and it came
that's
about,
what sets them apart.
Right, exactly. It came about that, oh no, the Chex Mix is just plated very close to where they do their salads.
Oh.
And a garbanzo bean ended up in our Chex Mix. So, oh. Just saying. I think local fine dining might be fake. Anyway.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I mean, heads up, I guess.
Yeah, heads up.
Okay. All right, so here's the question. Are you ready? Are you ready if everything in the newly elected administration were to come true? And so things that are on my mind that may be true. So they're intentionally looking for a reduction in what they're calling waste, fraud, and abuse from a government perspective. But I think it also crosses into what is like some of your more libertarian views, which is like, I don't know, maybe the government shouldn't be doing this. Either private sector or people individually should be doing those types of things.
Sure.
And so regardless of how excited you might be for that, I'm going to tell you right now that the reality is that there are some things that are like very distinctly wasteful for sure. And then there's all kinds of things where you're like, I don't think the government should be involved in that, but there are people who are receiving mm-hmm. services from this type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so even think about things like there's money that comes from the federal government in addition to just general taxes that are collected for like free and reduced lunches. Right. And so whatever you think about maybe the government is not good at this, healthcare and food and all kinds of things. If they just said tonight, okay, we're out.
Mm-hmm.
Like I want. Have you considered what that means? Because either you have to go something like, we should just stop doing free and reduced lunches. Like they'll figure it out. The parents will figure it out. I'm not sure that smells particularly like Jesus necessarily.
Yeah.
But are we doing any of those things? Like, are you prepared tomorrow? And so it's that kind of stuff where like maybe it feels politically right. Get the government out of that stuff. I don't really want them involved. But like, it's not that it just goes away. We have to ask ourselves, is there people responsibility?
Right.
And if so, how much of it is the Christians? Is it a Christian specific thing to be involved with or community type of thing to do? And so like that's one example. And so like, do you think that's a risk that we have of finding what feels like good political policy, reduction of size of government, people who aren't doing things efficiently? But like, if it seems to me that there is an impact then, cause that doesn't just go away. It does shift. And are we thinking about that?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I remember actually having that same conversation back in the Reagan administration.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, when we'd sit around in churches, talk about, okay, yeah, we need to cut this and cut that and cut that, and it'll be great, and that's how it's supposed to be, because this is the church's job.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, so are you ready then tomorrow to start feeding all of these people?
Yes.
Right. You know, because, and clothing them and all the things.
Yep.
And well, you know, they need to go work. You know, it's like, well, some of them will, you uh-huh. know, some of them will, some of them won't, you
yep.
know. And I don't, yeah, I think you're right. What would it take? I mean, we have to build from the ground up. I mean, it happens. It happened in the book of Acts,
yep.
you know, hey, let's get some food to the widows, you know, and oh boy, this isn't working. Reboot, you know,
yep.
Pick some guys. And it might be one of those situations. But the thing is, the early church had, you know, people selling property and laying it to the apostles' feet, saying,
right.
"Apostles' feet, saying, let's take care of the people." You know,
that's right.
And we don't have that now. Maybe we will then. Maybe yep. the people will say, "Oh, wait, it really does depend on that, and God has an ability to raise up people." It would take God raising up people in big ways, because what we've done, the church has become like lazy fat cats, and we got big buildings and big budgets, and we're spending more money on fog machines than we are feeding the poor, and like. Some churches will have to decide, well, do we want the fog or do we want people to eat?
Yeah.
And there'll be some that choose either way.
Yeah.
You know, and that'll say a lot.
Yes.
But it'll take a radical change in your average congregation.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think it's because even a lot of the conversation I'm hearing around this, they're like, hey, We think this will open up a new, kind of like a Reagan-era generation of, mm-hmm. of prosperity, but it's more about personal
right.
personal growth, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
hey, well, they're going to cut the taxes. Well, the taxes were paying for something, and there is totally some waste in there, but like, and you may not care about a lot of it. You might be like, hey, the government shouldn't be sponsoring the Save the Oregon Owl Fund, mm-hmm. okay? But like, here's the thing. You got the ability to not have to think about that owl because the government was doing it, you know? And just because you don't care about it doesn't mean it's probably not important. And like, there's so much going on. I actually think I was talking to somebody over the last couple of weeks that like one of the detriments I think we have is just in our modern age is I'm not sure we're built to be able to take in all the information that we're able to, or even all the destruction and sadness.
Yes, right.
You know, like it's just so much to carry around. And so like, and some of this solves because it pushes local. And so maybe your federal taxes go down, but your state taxes are going to have to go up because it's just not that simple. You're being very narrow and short-sighted to go, hey, I think we can cut this and we can lower all the taxes. And the stuff that was paying for just goes away. That's naive. Mm-hmm. Even if there's totally things to save, and like even if there's something where like it's hard, but you gotta do it. Like cutting, even if you try to cut the size of the government, those are still human beings. They still mm-hmm. have families. They still have pensions. They still have, you know what I'm saying. And so like even if this companies, even like non-government companies, have to go through this, like it sucks. It sucks mm-hmm. to have to make your company smaller, but like it has to be done. For the health of the company, and you realize you've got excess where you don't need it, or you can do things, you can trim it. But like, those are people still. They're mm-hmm. going to home to their three kids and their husband who got hurt in a work accident and hasn't worked for 3 years and a mortgage. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I have a very high caution of one being really too naive about this or being callous about it.
Yeah.
Like because it's like these are humans. These are yeah. human beings. These are all. And maybe you don't care about that owl. But let me ask you this question. Do you know enough about it? Do you know how important that owl is to the economy, to the balance, the eco balance in Oregon? I'm making this up. I don't have no idea about an owl in Oregon. I'm just saying that like it's easy to go, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
But the government's got its hands in way too many things. But I'm guessing that if you were pressed with it and you had all the information at your fingertips, you probably care and recognize that there's a lot more of those things you should care about mm-hmm. that somebody has to. You've had the privilege or the ignorance to go, well, the government's, I don't know, they're yeah, handling.
It's getting taken care of.
Yes.
We probably on average get 3 to 5 phone calls a week from strangers asking from help paying the rent.
Mm.
Okay, that's just right now.
Yeah.
Now, let's say you multiply that times 700.
Right.
I mean, even right now, I honestly don't even answer the phone anymore because it's so painful to say no. And right. then they tell all the stories, and I'm like, I still don't have any money. You
know? Yeah.
I mean, we're not that big of a church. We don't have – I mean, the biggest church can't do it all.
Yes.
You know,
right.
I mean, it's just – we just don't have it. And we actually help a lot of people that we are connected with, but you're just calling off the street. I, you know, there's nothing I can do. There really isn't.
Yeah.
And I think, man, that's just going to increase the number of people who are suddenly going to lose their homes.
Yes.
And there's this whole domino effect thing. Like right now, rent's really high, and space is low.
Yeah.
And so they're kicking people out now.
Right.
So they can raise rent.
Yep.
I mean, we've had people in our own church like, oh, you got to be out at the end of the month. They're like, what do we do? Nothing. But you're out. The lease
right.
is done. We're going to release your apartment for more money, and you can't afford it.
Yes.
And you know, yeah. I mean, that's just our own little congregation here. Like, I couldn't help her. You know, I can't pay your rent for you.
Yep.
You know, so it will take some digging deep to
yes.
Really help, to really do our job.
Yes. Yeah. And I think maybe that's the preparation is that whatever it is, if you start personally, and again, I'm fine with you thinking politically, this is probably right. It probably is. But like, if you think about how you might benefit from this type of economy, how you might benefit from these types of tax cuts and from the government getting smaller, are you prepared to go, yes, I can benefit from this and I fully intend to receive none of it?
Right.
Yeah.
Because it has to balance somewhere. And like, I would like to believe it is kind of a principle of the New Testament, even the early church. It's so weird. I've been I've been struggling, praying and thinking through this probably for longer than I'd like to admit, but even more so over the last few weeks, is that like the principle of like, hey, you don't work, you don't eat. That's actually still New Testament. That's not even like one of the old school ones. Like we still say that.
Yeah.
And the reality is that that culture was not struggling with a lot of freeloading.
They were raised understanding that. I guess that's what I was going to say too, that
yep.
It's going to be either a slow process or a quick education, but these people who've been raised with, well, you owe this to me.
Yes.
We're going to learn real quick.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. They got to figure something out.
But there's like, this is where it becomes difficult, is that like, you know, the way that the New Testament is talking about things, they're not having, they're saying widows and orphans because these are people who can't actually care for themselves. There's not an ability societally to do it. And it's why people, like, you bring your friend out and he begs at the gate and people would give him money because they're like, oh, we get it. But like our culture is not, there's not a shame to it. And what I mean is that like, I don't mean you're supposed to be going around like condemning everybody. What I'm saying, there's not an internal drive that goes, if I can work, then I will. If there's any way I can use any part of me to cover the burden that just living, existing is on the world around me, that I'm going to do my very best to do that. There is an entitlement and within our culture that's big enough that like, even if you rip the Band-Aid off, like what are you really, regardless of whether you don't like their attitude, you don't like their work ethic, are you going to look them in the eye 2 weeks later and go, I'm willing to let you starve to prove this point? Like, it's not so easy. God is more gracious than that in our stubbornness. And so even if you like it philosophically, it's not really going to be an option for you. And you're going to change people's behavior the same way we change gospel transformation. Like, it's not an easy thing to balance. I totally get it. But just at the end of the day, this is where it's easy to blame the government for getting bloated. But like, it mops up all the stuff we don't want to have to deal with. Because like at the end of the day, there's still all kinds of people without housing and without food and have to need medical care. And like someone's got to cover it. And you may not in principle like it, but you don't have to look anybody in the face and go, no, we're not going to take care. We're not going to provide you food. You can die in the street. And you shouldn't do that. But that means you don't have much extra resources. Like they're going to go out to things like that. And we can hope to change it culturally, but it's not going to happen tomorrow, to Dan's point. And so I worry that what feels like a political victory becomes a spiritual defeat because we're not thinking about the impact to the thing that is actually the treasure in heaven, which is human beings and their relationship with Jesus and their ability to be alive to hear it and their ability to just like during – I know I use this example a lot, but it's powerful to me. Just like during the bubonic plague and all those folks are getting saved because the people of Jesus are sacrificing themselves so that they may live even when their own families abandon them. And so like a lot of times this is what I get irritated with people who deride that Francis of Assisi quote where spread the gospel if necessary, use words. What he's saying is that like it should come out your hands, should come out your eyebrows, your elbows, your mouth, and all this stuff. And like that's going to look like this. And I'm sorry that the entitlement of our culture has shifted. It feels more righteous to help the Afghani, totally, because you're like, these people are entitled. But they still need Jesus. This is still our backyard. You're going to have to be open to what that means and how it bends your political and social philosophies in the reality of Jesus's kindness for us and allowing the rain to come on our unjustness the same way we're going to do that in giving to people who are on the other side of what may be wise politically. It made me think of another thing. Like that's the money, that's the resources stuff. And I think it's pretty easy. And I do think you should be praying on it. You prepare thy heart for your prosperity that may come to go to others. it also localizes some things you didn't realize that the government was taking care of. Like, I don't know, look around. Your schools are, there's going to be some, there'll be cuts to things. There'll be like community centers and like not all that. Some of that stuff's run off of, you know, they're local taxes, and so it's not a big deal. But, like, there's a lot of money that gets kicked in from the federal government to the state governments. And maybe we don't like that because it's undue influence from a large federal government. If you don't take the money, you don't have to do the thing. But then again, you don't get the money. And so, anyway, I'd keep your ears out. I'd be praying on it and say, Lord, as this stuff may shift around me, help me be wise and open to it. Here's the other one, though, is I do think you're going to start seeing, like I said, I think you're seeing it culturally, too, especially with the like some of the protections or acclimation to like various genders and things like that. I think you saw that. And I think that pendulum is starting to swing societally. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's something that doesn't come up as part of either the disbanding of the Department of Education or like just how some of the government level things and policies react to some of those protections. But maybe we like that. Maybe morally we're like, hey, we think this was supporting confusion and we're glad for the change. But I want you to hear that people who were feeling marginalized, misunderstood, and on the exterior of society had some level of belief that maybe that wasn't the case in the presence of these things, mm-hmm. like regulations, protections. Even if you believe that it is for their benefit and for the benefit of society that these things start to pull back, those are still human beings. They're going to feel even more so marginalized than they perhaps did before, because at least felt like, well, I'm not sure everybody's there, but the government at least is on our side. And I'm thinking about like discrimination policies and
right.
like that kind of stuff. And so that is the work of Jesus. I'm just like the consequence of that, even if it has a broad policy benefit. If you can think about this of any law that we go, hey, maybe it restricts abortion. And you think that's good. It's a good protection of life. Doesn't automatically just eliminate women who are in difficult situations. You know what I'm saying? And so it's that kind of stuff where like they are opportunities for the church to be the church, for the people of the church to be the church, to love and serve, and to now that if that gets removed, to double down on creating relationships and developing trustworthy interactions so that people can understand, like, this. These are the heart of these types of things. This is the reality of who Jesus is and what he thinks about you. Because it's possible that some of those government facades, if I'm going to think of them that way, won't be there anymore. And this is not a time – that's not a declaration of – it's not a holistic spiritual victory. Because it still leaves folks who aren't seeing it the way we believe that Jesus sees it.
It's humans of balance.
Right. And so, again, for the same reasons, I would think about that. What does it look like then to intentionally interact, engage, provide service to, provide whatever things to folks who feel like government policies they're going to be on the other side of? And whether it be advocates for abortion in any given state. There's all kinds of things where like I might look at it and go, yes, that reflects what I believe is morally correct, but it does not change the humanity that is impacted on the other side of it. And what we risk is celebrating a political victory and then just like failing the spiritual opportunity that exists. Like, this is the time to double down. I said, I know you completely disagree with me on this. I still am going to care about you and serve you in that way. And so don't celebrate the wrong thing. Don't miss the thing that we're here for, even if we're okay. Like, it's, these things are heading in a direction that you like. And so that one also occurred to me that it's the time to double down. If you're not doing it now for whatever reason, like, this would be the time to double down on it, because it's going to feel even worse. It's going to feel like harsher and more ostracized and – again, focus like this is this maybe we don't even have to read that article, but I think the broad sum up to me was you miss that when all you're thinking about is national.
Right.
You miss a human. It's frankly, this is where a lot of people flip following Jesus and then they flip on some social issue that I'm not sure Jesus is aligned with, is because they meet a person and they meet a human being and it's not what they expected. And they're like, well, maybe this changes the stuff. I just didn't know. And the miss there was not being around people who are different than you and hearing different ideas and understanding that and letting go of something that God said was true and looking at someone and going, I want this because I continue to believe it's what's best for you because what God said was best for you. Like, it's that it all kind of leans on what God says is best here. But they get surprised. They're like, oh, we get this cartoonish version of people that comes from political commentary and like a limited Facebook feed and all this other jazz. And then you meet human beings and it felt like that, it felt like you were misled and lied to, and you probably were, because you were given a cartoonish vision of what people are like. And so, anyway, whatever thing that is, I would be, don't miss it as a spiritual opportunity that has always existed, but I think will be exacerbated perhaps on even things that you agree with politically.
Yeah. You know, I think we get our impressions of people through the voices of spokespeople on either side of any issue, and they give us the bullet points of what this person looks like and how they act and how they think and how they feel. And yeah. So that's that where we develop that cartoonish figure. And then when you actually talk to someone who is in that category, you go, well, gosh, you don't seem at all like the person on, you know, TV said you were B.
Right.
And so it'd be kind of nice almost to get rid of some of that stuff and just go back to talking to people again, you know, the face to face and just as human beings,
yes,
you know, and I think the church has lost that too, because we quickly jump on the side, whichever side we're on,
yep,
and that's where we are, and then we're just, you know, don't trust the other side at all.
Yeah.
The person who has that label, even though they don't even know they're on a side, they're just like doing their life, you know,
right,
like, I don't know, I'm golf fishing, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so we do have to be careful and treat people as human beings and come with them with the love of Christ and let God do his work.
And I do think like that same thing exists heading the other direction. Like I was listening to somebody just given the most like comically cartoonish version of a Christian that they were like this, and a lot of it gets aimed at parents in some way or another. Mm-hmm. But I was listening to this, I'm like, I'm trying to be honest. I'm like, I don't know, are these fair critiques? And I thought, literally, I do not know anybody like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't, not in my sphere. And I'm not saying they don't exist, but I'm just saying, like, I know for a fact, in my sphere, I know no one that is behaving the way these people are talking about. Mm-hmm. And I thought, it's possible they've never met a Christian.
Yeah, right.
Like, or one who's actually following Jesus. That seems also possible.
Right.
And so, what we believe has consequences, like, obviously the truth matters. Jesus is still king. But, like, you can hold those truths and then recognize the complicated, gray fallibility and frailty of human beings around you because you share it with them.
Yes.
And I always... There's a phrase that a lot of people will use, Christians will use, and they're like, I'm just another like beggar hoping for bread. And I think it's right, like technically right. I've been uncomfortable with it because I think again it diminishes, like God still loves you. You just don't suck all the time. And like I'm just not sure it's good for us to be thinking that. But the concept is right in that like how. If you looked at someone in such a way that like either you made all these presumptions about them or just thought their life was not complicated, like yours is complicated. It's difficult to hold on to your beliefs. It's difficult to make decisions. It's especially if you don't have a grounding in Jesus. I actually don't know what it's like to have to make decisions where I did not have at least a core set of principles that I could go back to that weren't established by me. Because then I have to trust, like, do I even – the core ways of the principles of which I've decided internally to live my life that didn't, if they didn't come from God, like even those can't be trusted. I feel like I'd be floating around in the wind all the time. But like, I just, we think of other people poorly if you're not willing to, if you don't just look at them and go, boy, I bet their life's difficult and complicated and it's hard to find a right decision. And sometimes it feels like you only have wrong ones. And the only thing that provides me some level of center is that Jesus is king, and I know that, and then now I'm kind of starting, that's my go,
yep.
And then I can branch out. If you don't have that, am I terribly surprised that these are difficult things, and you don't even have a moral, think of just some of the things where, like, you have a moral orientation, and sometimes it's hard to come to that same, like, to walk with that. And so, anyway, this is, bottom line, it's just kindness, and being, recognizing humans, and being kind, and embracing the reality that people are gray. And so it's, if you cannot handle hearing national things without otherwise tossing that onto a bunch of humans around you, then you don't get to listen to it. And I would say that extends even at the state level. Magazines or newspapers or like internet posts that reach more than 10 people. Like if you can't take that in without automatically coloring all the various people around you, then you can't take it in. You're not allowed to use it anymore. You have to shake hands. You have to look people in the eye. You go serve at the food bank with people. You go find the most liberal church in the area and you go offer to serve at their food bank. I'm just saying, like, it reminds you that although your principles are not going to bend because the gospel doesn't, but you're going to bring it with you because you believe the gospel changes everything.
Yes, right.
And you believe that the gospel is still good news when it comes to serving your community and providing medical care and bringing food to the food bank. And like, what are you going to go hide in the food pantry where they only people who agree with you are at? Like, go stand by a guy. You're like, boy, that guy, I don't know. We are different people. Okay, great. Like, the more you can embrace that, while still holding on to what you know to be true because you are the truth bringer, the better the world gets. And the more you don't get clouded up by stuff that's too big for us to be able to take in and use competently. That you're listening live from the path. And maybe you have some thoughts on that. Maybe do you see other opportunities that, again, just like, you know, to have a base idea of what the Trump administration is considering doing. And you're like, okay, what are the implications for the church? For people? That's where it's cautious. I don't mean like, hey, wait for your elder board to do something. I mean, what are you going to do, friend? Look around right. Your community. What are you going to do? And then maybe you got some feedback for us. Hit us up on the Live from the Path complaint line, 515-517-0085. Call or text. I'd be curious on your thoughts. What do you think exists out there? Where do I get it wrong? Where does Buva have it wrong? You know, whatever the thing. Dan's got it right, obviously. But like where Buva and I might be incorrect, we'd like to hear about it. All right.
Great.
Okay. Buva, tell me about your you hit up the Witch of Endor, and it's giving you the business.
So I paraphrased a little bit earlier, and I did so incorrectly. I said that the witch was like worried that she saw a god. That wasn't the situation.
Right.
So in 1 Samuel 28, essentially Saul is asking his servants, starting in 7, I won't read the whole chapter, but I'll grab hold a couple of the verses that are important. So Saul says in verse 6, he says, "When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him."
Yep.
Either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her." And his servants said to him, "Behold, there is a medium at Endor." So Saul disguised himself and put on other garments and went, he and two men with him. And
they so cartoonish of a situation. I know.
And they came to the woman by night, and he said, "Divine for me by a spirit and bring up for me whomever I shall name for you." And she basically goes, "No, don't you know that I'll die if I do that?" The Saul's basically said, "Absolutely not. As a king, all the mediums and necromancers are going to die." Saul says, "No, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." Then she goes, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" He said, "Bring up Samuel for me." Mm-hmm. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see a god coming up out of the earth." So I did kind of say it right. Not yet. Yeah.
Yep,
so,
yep.
And he said to her, "What is appearance?" Blah, blah, blah. All this different stuff. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answered, "I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what I shall do." Then Samuel goes on to be like, "You friggin' idiot."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Taking a step back here.
Yep.
So, I am now in a place where, one, I believe this is fully true. I don't think that this was a story that was meant to be like, and then Saul had a dream where he went and spoke to this witch. Like, I believe wholeheartedly that Saul did go and seek out the wisdom of this medium who then summoned the spirit of Samuel.
Okay.
And Samuel the prophet shows up.
Yep.
And then everyone around is like, "Yep, this is what happens when you are a necromancer or a medium." And Samuel's walking up and going, "Are you freaking kidding me? Like, why are you calling me to this?"
Yep.
So that's a lot to take in.
Yep.
Because I don't know if I've ever just sat in that for a moment and went, "Okay, is that something I need to worry about now? And is that something where people are currently doing that, and there is a worry?" Well, not necessarily a worry. Like, I know who's ultimately in control, but like, people are evil and messed up. And are people currently doing this stuff? And do I need to be you know, mindful of that and make certain that I'm being cautious of what mediums and necromancers exist. Mm-hmm. And then also, I don't know what that says to me about what I believed at the death of someone, that their spirit can be called up by this woman who is a medium, and Saul just kind of comes walking, or Samuel, comes walking on up, is like, why? Why have you called to me? Like, of course the Lord's not going to answer you. You're no longer his anointed. Like, you screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what? Like, as men who I know have preached this or are about to or have walked through this before and have tried to take in the concept of, like, an Old Testament history piece and then what that means for us in today's day and age, being in a post-Jesus place of the Holy Spirit coming upon us and all of that stuff.
Yep.
What are there things that I need to be worried about here? Like, is it, what am I, help me understand this.
I don't know if you need to be worried.
Sure.
You need to be aware that there is a very active and real spiritual world.
Yep.
And that there is evil and there is, you know, God, and you just want to stay on the right side.
Okay.
I mean, whether this was, you know, this is something that's repeated, or I've always come from the side that what you see today with mediums and stuff is more demonic in nature, not like actual people coming back from the grave, but,
yeah,
you know, demons who are familiar spirits that
sure,
you know, they know all the stuff. They can say what they want, and they know all the details and can speak the voice even, you know. So is it a worry? No, you're on, you know, you're in God's kingdom. You're doing his stuff. Mm-hmm. I haven't even looked at this verse for so many years that I, you know, I can't even tell you what I originally, you know, studied on this.
Sure. Yeah.
But it appears to be the real deal. I mean, very well could be just a special situation where, like, obviously it's in scripture and
yeah,
God's teaching his people a very important lesson. But, you know, as far as concern that, you know, someone from the past is going to come back or something, haunt you or something, it's nothing like that.
Sure, yeah.
Or you're more thinking, like, also that could people be trying legitimately,
yes, right,
to get a hold of the
dead? Yeah, so ultimately, yeah. And I totally agree, yeah, with that. And I think that worry is probably the wrong way to put it, because I don't, yeah, from a negative connotation, like, I'm not worried that someone is going to be able to be a medium, bring a spirit back, and they're going to have more power than my God.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
not something I'm at all worried about.
Because obviously a cultural thing, all the shows on ghosts and everything.
Well, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
everybody thinks there's ghosts
kind
floating
of trying
around
to figure and, out because, like, yeah, I think that as I've encountered or have secondhand encountered through stories, people talking about the spiritual world. And the concept of a realm where spirits exist, demons, whatever, that kind of thing, right? Like, I've never doubted that, mm-hmm, and I certainly understand that there is a caution to understanding that exists, and it is wrong to be dismissive of all of those thoughts and just go, that's not a thing, and that's not right. Like, Jesus very specifically talks about it, and it interacts with that world, and his disciples do as well, right? And like that, I'm supposed to take in. But it reminded me of the last time we had kind of an Ask the Pastor situation, where is this something that is a specific piece that is being called out here, that I am to take as an isolated story kind of thing, very similar to what we talked about, the concept of the baptism, and then James and Peter, or John and Peter, coming down and like checking on that area and then laying hands on them, and then the Spirit comes on it, right? Like, that's a one-time story that we're to kind of take in isolation because there was a protection on the church as it was starting, right? But like, and so I don't think that I need to take that for all baptisms going forward, that there's another step kind of thing. As I'm reading through this kind of story, the way that they're talking about it, at least the concept that, like, Saul very specifically has laid consequences against people in the area who are doing this, means that she's not the only one. Like, this is,
yeah,
just, this is a medium there. There's necromancers. That's the word that's used. I'm sure there's Hebrew behind that I'm probably missing that I could go into and study. But from what I understand, that's interaction with the dead, right? And very clearly, this medium at Endor is able to, it's not her first time. It's not something that she was like, oh, I guess I'll give it a shot. She was like, no, I'm not going to do it because you'll kill me. And then he goes, he won't. She goes, okay, fine. What name do you want? Right? Like, that seems to be just a Tuesday for this gal. And as I'm understanding that, the thing that hits me weirdly is this understanding of maybe it's a misunderstanding of even further on the concept of a heaven or hell and where we would go after we shed this mortal coil, if you will. And is it at a point where obviously Samuel has died, and is his spirit just able to be called upon by this medium? And what does that mean? Or am I to pull any meaning from that about what I'm doing now and what happens when I die?
No, yeah, I would be super, given that it happens one time.
Sure, yeah.
I would be super cautious of developing any, basically you don't have a pattern.
Yes,
all
right,
you've got
right.
is one dot on a graph.
Yep, yeah, right.
Yeah. Even if it happened twice, you have
it's
a line,
two dots,
but
yes.
that's all you got.
Right, yep,
and
totally
so,
fair.
What I think is the more reasonable what I believe is right is that I actually think she does this all the time, but it's all bogus, just like it's bogus now.
Sure.
She has no power to call a soul that belongs to Yahweh
right.
at her service.
Right.
Right. But what I do think is happening. So like Saul, I was actually thinking about this just on the drive in for I'm teaching through 1 Samuel. But one of the key questions is that, like, did God make a mistake by choosing Saul? And the answer is no, because what he did was, like, they said, give us a king like the other nations. So God got them a king like the other nations. Like, the description we get of Saul, remember, he didn't even know, he stumbles into Samuel, right? He didn't even know the man of God was, like, 20 miles south of him. And so he tried to, and like, his servant suggests, hey, should we, what do we have to give to the man of God, the seer, so he can tell us where these donkeys are at that had been lost? And, like, anybody who knows Samuel and follows Yahweh would go, you don't pay him. Like, what are we doing here? And so, and the description you get of Saul doesn't say he's a good leader. As a matter of fact, the first introduction is that he lost his donkeys. Like, he's not a good leader.
He's just a tall dude.
Yeah, exactly. Which is like, how do you choose that? They describe George Washington that way.
Yes.
Like, he was a head taller than everybody else. Uh-huh. And like, it's why we're intimidated by Goliath and the Nephilim. It's like, they're big. It's how the nations pick a king. And so what God does is go, okay, you want a king? First, I'm going to show you the king that you asked for.
Interesting.
So even though it says God picked Saul, he did.
Yes, right.
But it wasn't because he made a mistake. It's because he goes, I warned you about this. You said you're okay with it. And so I'm going to show you what your king looks like.
Yeah, the beginning of that story is like, here's all the warnings of why you should not want
yes,
this king.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So then, but then see what happens
and
then. And then ultimately, as he picks David, when we say that David is a man after God's own heart, it's because it's a king like God wanted. Yahweh, I think Yahweh's okay with a king for these folks. It talks about it in Deuteronomy.
Sure.
It talks about it in the Psalms. Like, it's not anti-king so much as it is anti-not the king like the rest of the nations have. What does a king look like that should be for the nation of Israel? It should be a humble servant who is a steward of God's word and using that to lead the people, right?
Right.
That's what David is. And so it's not a mistake God makes. It's a God showing them what they asked for. This is what you actually get. And then here's what it looks like if I were to choose your king. If you were to ask me the right way. Or not even like the right way, but like even when they asked for Saul, they said, hey, Saul or Samuel, will you go find us a king? They didn't say, hey, petition Yahweh.
Right.
We would like a ruler over us because we're a bit unwieldy across all of our judges. They do effectively what is like the reverse American Revolution. Is everything we fought to get out of from England, these guys are wanting it.
They're like, we're in for it.
Put it in. We want the king.
He gets a bunch of stuff. We got to work his land and it's not ours anymore. We're in.
Seems fine. Like, hey, you're able to manage all your own stuff. It's more local. You just got local judges and stuff. We're like, nah, we want the big.
Give us a central point of government.
So now I say all that to say, now look at what's going on with him at this Witch of Endor. Saul continues to prove that he's not listening to Yahweh.
Right, over and over again.
He does things without asking or without waiting. Like, he's not a good spiritual leader. He like God continues to kind of, he still says, you'll see this repeated, like, you're still my people. And so God continues to like work on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
But Saul is just played out as the not a competent king. So, but think though, once things switch to David, which is now this is happening, Saul's not hearing anything anymore. He's got that tormented thing, right? Like, he's constantly...
He gets the weird spirit put on him after David gets anointed in his house with Jesse and all of them.
Yep, that's right. And so, like, it continues to demonstrate that, like, the person that you chose, in fact, the word Saul means basically, like, you chose.
Oh. That's
what the name Saul is. It's like, you chose him. It's a terrible name. But like, so I think what this is, like, why is this story important? Because, like, it doesn't actually further the plot of anything. It continues to demonstrate, it's included in the scriptures, because it continues to show you how a human, chose by human measure as a king, will attempt to solve problems.
Yeah, he keeps screwing it up over and over again, going to the wrong things.
And he goes to a necromancer that he condemned. He expressly forbid necromancy.
Right, because there's been times where he's done the right thing. Like, it's been slim, but there have been times where it's like, oh, you're going to profane the name of Yahweh my God?
Yep.
Then I'm going to come and destroy you.
Yes.
But then we get the beginning of the David story where another one shows up trying to profane the name of God, Goliath, and he just goes, well, I'm scared of that, and I'm running from that situation.
Right.
And David, ruddy young shepherd, is like, nope. We're not dealing with that. Somebody get me a friggin' get me something. I need 5 stones. Like,
yes.
I'm taking care of the situation.
So I think the point, more than anything else, is that he shows up and, like, he no longer, like, Samuel's dead.
Yes, right.
Right? And so who is God working through? David.
Yeah.
Saul does not have a means to otherwise hear from Yahweh. And so he goes to this, and basically, I think this is God, like, so I think God is allowing this.
Sure.
And so, because, like, it's not like the necromancer can control Samuel.
Right. That's what I was trying to understand is because if this is such a practice that it's been banned in the area, and, like, obviously Saul recognizes, even if it's in his folly, really, he recognizes that there is some power to be able to try and figure out, maybe she can get me a spirit that can speak to me.
Or perceived, because, like, it's the same
thing. Sure, right, yeah.
Think of it, it's the same thing that happens, you don't tear down the Asherah poles or the Dagon temples because you're worried about Dagon.
Right.
But you tear them down because people have misplaced.
Yes, right,
and do
atrocious things there.
Yes, and so I think it's the same thing. This is, like, a lot of times people will, like, they go to this today. In fact, I have a family member, like, it's a bit distant, but, like, they went to a medium to try to talk to some deceased other family member.
Gosh.
But here's the thing. If you want it, there's all kinds of things that will convince you that the thing was happening.
Yeah, right. Totally.
It's the same way that you can be convinced that someone has a crush on you when they don't. You're like, oh, they dig on me.
I've never experienced that.
That's right.
I've never been in that place, Ben.
We're easily manipulated. And so, anyway, what I think is happening here is I think he goes to this thing. He's trying a different outlet, and I think God actually meets him there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And then the thing that Samuel says is true. I think it's from it's from Yahweh. And it's basically a final nail in the coffin. Is not the vision I want. But, like,
it kind of is.
It's the thing where it seals. As a matter of fact,
you're going to die tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd have to check. He doesn't hear from Yahweh again. Right?
No.
This is it.
No.
This is the thing.
Within the next 3 chapters, him and his sons are dead.
Right. But now here's what we know. Now think about from a narrative perspective, why do I care about this part of the story? It matters for Saul because now I know Saul did not just die on the battlefield. It wasn't just a human thing where he goes out there and he's like, oh, we didn't succeed. Oh, shoot.
Right.
Like, this was known. It was within Yahweh's control, and Saul knew it.
Totally.
And now the people of Israel knew it and say, this was the ultimate end to when you asked for a king and I gave you what you asked
for. Wow.
So, like— It's
important to pull all of that out, obviously, yes, right?
Yes.
And look at it through the entire narrative of the story. Just as much as you would do the same for David, right, as you would do for Saul, and all the things that happened within David into 2 Samuel, as you take into these. Yeah, I guess I never thought of it like, here's the deal. I'm realizing so much more nowadays as I'm going through and reading my Bible that I have been reading my Bible in a vacuum more often than not.
Yeah.
And I've been doing myself a disservice to my understanding of narratives by going chapter to chapter or verse to verse and going and not taking any step back and going, what happened in the chapter before this?
Yeah.
Like, what is the larger narrative that I am to know if this is 5,000 years later or whatever you want to look at, right? Like, what am I to know about the character of God based off of this little piece? Because I'm convinced that I'm not finding any real doozies in any story that I've read that it's like, well, that's a weird thing that has nothing to do with anything else I've been reading.
Right.
Because I mean, admittedly, for years, I read my Bible and went from one moment to the next of like, what? That's weird.
Yeah.
Well, that's a weird thing right there. Oh, that was weird. I'm going to take that back. Yeah. Rarely ever do I step back and go like, how do I take this in through the entire perspective of the narrative that I've gotten? How often do I read the beginning of a scroll in light of the end of the scroll before it?
Yeah.
And it changes everything.
Yeah, that's kind of the point, is that so like even then, you know, that story happens in chapter 28. The context for that starts in chapter 8.
Yes, right.
Like you got, like, and so here's one of the key things, just like a hint on how you, if you find something wacky in scripture, one of the things you can ask yourself, and you're not going to know the answer, but the thought exercise is good, which is, why is this even here?
Sure, yeah.
Because if you're Yahweh, do you go, you know what they need is that wild ape of a necromancer story just to put them in the old tizzy.
Yes, right.
There's no reason to include that. And you know you're getting limited stories, right?
Yes.
Like we're getting thousands of years over, you know, a good 120 chapters across books. You're not getting everything. And so why the heck is this here? Why would you tell this story? And so by the time you go back and go, he's telling the story, because it becomes clear that God has completely cut off Saul, that this, but and that his death, not only is Saul aware of it, but now the people of Israel know that God was like this was on purpose.
Sure.
He was going to die. And then you go, well, the necromancer part isn't actually even all that important.
No.
It is what happened, and it's certainly interesting,
sure, yeah,
the undead Samuel. Right. But like, is that what he's intending you to focus on?
Yeah, right.
No, the key part was the thing that, like, that's why this is here.
Yes, exactly.
And so,
why is Saul in the circumstance that he's in? What has led him to this? What is
right.
Yahweh doing through the circumstance that led to a Saul in the first place?
Yes.
What happened with Israel that even led them to a point that they were asking for a king in the first place, right? Like,
yep.
there's 50,000 questions to ask of the small subsection that you're snapshotting right now,
yeah,
and then taking step backs and looking into that. And it's interesting that you say that from the perspective of like, it's such a long story that we're only getting very small snapshots of. I came to that spearhead very recently again with Genesis 1 through 11.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, you get Genesis 1 through 11 beginning all the way through to like Abraham, and there's barely anything in there.
Yeah.
Like it's literally barely anything. And I was talking about it, gave a very high level summary to the people that have been coming to our house on Sundays of Genesis 1 through 11, just to kind of set some basics of the Christmas season and to kind of talk about what we're talking about with Jesus in the first place,
yeah,
and why we need him. And as I wrapped up Genesis 1 through 11, somebody goes, wow, so that's the Old Testament. And I went, and I couldn't help myself. I went, no, that's the first 11 chapters. And they went, wait, what? I was like, yeah, that's the first 11 chapters of 50 in the first scroll. And that's one of five that we call the Torah. And that's one of like 39 that we call the Old Testament. Like this is nothing of
right.
what I just talked about. And so it's funny to take a step back and find myself in that too.
Yeah.
Of making certain that as I look at that, and it's very important, what am I focusing on here? Why is this a focus? Like, what is the point? God didn't tell any random one-offs to go, hey, surprise them with this one. Like, really throw them off and
right.
scare them or surprise them about my character and then never explain it and talk about this thing again. That way they leave it and go, what the heck?
Yeah.
And then just move past that kind of thing.
Because yeah.
that's definitely been the way that I've read my Bible historically, has been, well, that was weird, God. Okay, moving on. And
yeah.
I've done myself a disservice in that. So
yeah, and it's a lot of that happens just because, like, think of how you set up your Bible reading programs.
Yes.
Especially, like, you got ones that kind of bounce around. You're like, well, a couple of chapters here, a couple of chapters here. And, like, it's not wrong, but, like, it does sometimes do you a disservice because
yeah.
you're like, well, I took in these two stories and that freaking witch. And then you're like,
right.
I don't know what to do with that. But if someone told you, think of it like you talking about Genesis 1 to 11 and, like, you're looking at people in the eye.
Yeah, right.
If someone told you that story of Saul and David and just gave it to you
yes.
like a narrative that took them about 65 minutes to walk through, you wouldn't. Like, it's interesting. Like, the witch
sure,
is totally
there's
interesting.
A part. Yeah, right.
Right. But, like, you would see, oh, okay.
Yes,
I see
right.
how this thing is arcing
yep.
down. And here's where we get, I'll go on too long for this, so I won't, I'll make this real quick. But, like, we get hesitant about this because we've grown somehow, I think this is like Reformation type of stuff, but we've gotten uncomfortable with the Bible writers as narrative storytellers.
Yeah.
Like, we're treating them like newspapermen. Mm-hmm. Like, they just wrote down the stuff that God put in their mind or that they saw, and that their job was to do that. But they're not. And you know they're not. Like, you've read poetry. Poetry is definitely not that. You've seen the Gospels, and you've seen the Gospel writers move things around.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, what the heck? This is untrustworthy. It's not untrustworthy. It's just they're not trying to tell you just, like, as if they were an eyewitness with binoculars sitting on the sides. There are the thing peels like an onion. Here's the true things that happened. If you look at them in this order, if you recognize that these are connected, you learn even more.
Absolutely.
You get even deeper than that. And so like the stories that we get, the stories that we don't get, like these are intentional things. And like if you believe that the Word of God is inspired by the Holy Spirit and that the words we have matter and that the translations are largely like God is making sure that you're getting something pretty consistent across all the languages, then why would you have a problem that he uses a narrative arc?
Sure.
You wouldn't. Like, God is not capable. Like, his limitation is our fact-gathering limitation.
Yeah.
Or am I not surprised that the same artistic God who possibly sings the world into existence has got some narrative flair and retains me something that I get to see a true set of information and then an even bigger true set of information because of how it's written. And so, like, I don't have a problem with this at all, but I used to. You catch me when I'm 22, I'm like hardcore going, look, I don't know much. I'm probably not even following Jesus very well, but I know I'm supposed to say every bit of this stuff is infallible and every word of this is true. And the truth would be like the way I would say legal statements.
Yeah, sure, right.
And it's too narrow.
Right.
Ends up being wrong because it's too narrow.
Yeah.
And so it takes time to get used to that. It
yes.
does take time to get used to that it's okay, because it feels like what you're giving up is like, oh, you mean it's not the exact newspaper
yes.
truth? The gospel tells me lies. It doesn't, but it's because we're too narrow on what we believe God and how God can speak. That's the risk.
The book of Samuel is what broke that for me.
Mm.
Like, the book of Samuel's that way because like it's talked about later on in the second part of Samuel. Samuel's dead. And
yeah.
like there's parts of it where it seems like it's from the mouth of Samuel.
Yeah.
And
right.
so it can't possibly be that way.
Right.
And so if you're trying to take it in like a history book, that's the wrong way to put it. If you're trying to take it in like a snapshot of a videotape of what's happening in the moment,
yeah.
it fails. But like if you look at it to go like, oh, but how am I to understand the character of Yahweh, how he interacts with his people, and then how he sets up to fulfill the promises of the covenants that he makes? And I can take that into perspective when I look at the book of Samuel across both movements, if you will, whatever you want to call them, right?
Yep.
It's hysterical you say that. Literally, Samuel is what broke that for me, and I had to go, oh, crap. That's
yeah.
not the way that I can read this.
Yeah.
It's not.
You know what's interesting is it's very likely that the writer who finishes Deuteronomy, because we know Moses doesn't write all this. Moses did.
Right,
so
yes.
So it can't be Moses. And like it tends to be like, well, what happened to Moses? He died. Like, what do you
yeah,
mean?
Right.
And
he died.
Someone else kept writing the story. What do I care? It's not the book of Moses.
Right.
And there's not a man named Deuteronomy. And so, you know, and it's actually likely that the same, like with as we trace the text, that you likely have kind of the final. Again, I don't have a problem with editing either.
Yeah.
Or compilers, like
sure,
people
yeah.
who are compiling the story. But like the end of Deuteronomy up through like 1st, 2nd Kings is also probably the same people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think it's probably a guy. It's probably a group of people who are like stewards of the
yeah.
stories. And you know, you've got Deuteronomy. You get through Judges. You got Ruth, Samuel. 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Chronicles probably. Like, this is probably the same group of people who's, like, finally pulling all these things together because they're stories that people are just telling each other. You didn't have to write it down.
Yeah.
And so even then, you can keep moving these boundaries out, and then you can actually see similar themes towards, like, Moses' last blast through Deuteronomy.
Uh-huh.
Up through Judges, then through the Chronicles and Kings, the 1st and 2nd Samuel. Like, these themes are not different.
No.
There's things within the way that the language is that, I don't know, it could be different people. It could very well be the same group of people.
Sure. Yep.
But, like, I just – there's – if I trust Yahweh on the stories are true and the text is good, then I can trust him with grander narratives. And it'll take a while, but I do very much encourage you to get on board with that, because then what it does is it helps me go – the witch is interesting, but I'm less, or that what happened to Moses, I'm less likely to get stuck on that stuff.
Sure, yep.
Because it sits in a context in which I'm like, actually, that's not even where I'm supposed to be focusing. I'm just like a curious fella.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, like, and that's the thing. Like, as I was reading this, I recognized that I'm taking in the story that is the continuation of Saul, well, the continuation and ending of Saul's story, starting in chapter 8 all the way through,
yep.
And really starting in chapter 1, to be honest, about like the setting up of why we even have a Saul in the first place,
right? And then before that.
And then before that, right, all the way through to in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth.
Yeah.
But like, and I'm understanding that like there's very obviously there's been an anointing of Saul that happens, and then things get screwed up because he was not the dude and had messed things up. There's an anointing of David, and then very specifically, he does all the right things that Saul failed at, not 15 chapters prior, not really 8 chapters prior. Mm-hmm. And so like, as I'm taking in all those pieces and I totally fell into this, and I'm glad we pulled it back out of like understanding that as I look at the medium at Endor and take that in, I'm not looking at, oh no, what am I supposed to know about mediums now in the spiritual world and all this different stuff of like, am I going to get called back someday after I'm dead kind of thing? And then more I look at it of like, oh, what's the actual story? And like, what is being highlighted here by the fact that Saul, who was once meant to be the anointed king, that was that, even to the point where David's like, I can't kill the anointed, and then laments after his death because he was the anointed king. It's the same dude that screwed all this up, that was the hurl of the spear at his buddy and his son kind of guy, and then holy crap, take in the story of Saul. It's important to take a step back and go, I need to look at the medium of Endor, not as just this very important character in this specific thing. How am I to understand the story of Saul and David in this time, and then even greater, how am I supposed to understand the identity of my creator and how he interacts and how he sets up things that he says he's going to do?
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say is that don't feel like, don't skip over those, though.
No.
Because one of the things that those really quirky stories do is they actually help you remember the other things.
Uh-huh.
Like, even if I was reading as a kid, the thing that would stick out to me is this witch.
Oh, totally.
Right? But if I use the opportunity and kind of figure it out, I was like, oh, okay, this is the linchpin. Like, this thing brings together a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to forget all that. It's just the way your mind connects information.
Sure.
If you can come back 2 years later and you remember the witch, you'll remember the other things that go with it.
Yeah.
And so...
And the writers and compilers knew that.
Yeah, like, interesting pieces. You're like, oh, like, Goliath is another interesting story.
Yeah.
Like. There's plenty of valor of David type of stuff. There's a reason we're talking about this giant in this way, because it sticks with you.
Yes.
And then if you can just take one moment, figure out how this is progressing, this broader narrative, you get the advantage of, one, knowing that, and then two, your mind connects things. You'll keep the rest of the things with you. So it's okay to know the quirky stories. It helps tie things together. It's just how your mind works.
Totally fair.
All right, you listen to Life from the Path. I tell you what, I think we're going to have to do advice because the show tarries forth. So we're going to pick up the lament of the spiritual leader, and maybe all spirituality is local, maybe for next week.
All right. Dear Life from the Path. Several members of my husband's family let us down badly by not attending our daughter's wedding. They had various work and other family obligations near the date of our event. Save the date cards had been sent out 6 months prior, but we were apparently lower on their priority list. I expressed to my husband my desire to not send holiday cards this year because I no longer feel good about these family members. Then, while I was traveling for work, he bought cards, printed a letter with pictures, signed it from both of us, and sent it to most of his family and some of our mutual friends.
Well, good for him.
The first I heard about it was from a friend thanking me for the card and pictures a month later. I discussed it with my husband and got an apology, but I'm still shocked and saddened. What do you think?
I don't understand. Like, there's one thing to say, hey, I don't really feel like it. There's another thing to be antagonistic because someone else did.
Yeah.
She's lying. It's not that she doesn't feel like it. She wishes to exact some sort of revenge to make them understand how much they hurt her in their behavior.
Sure.
And she was using the Christmas cards as a very petty and naive way of going about it. And her husband ruined her pettiness.
Yes.
And she's mad.
There was an emotional debt that she felt like she was owed in that moment to stay angry about. And her husband robbed her of that.
And it wasn't even her wedding.
No, it was their daughter's.
You're right.
Right.
It's like, come on.
Oh, and right. It was because they didn't come to the wedding.
Yeah. They had to do other things like work.
Okay, I mean, it sounds lame, but here's the thing. There's something naive about what I'm going to say, and I think I recognize it. It runs the risk of being self-fulfilling, and you don't ever press yourself to potentially change or be better. But I am continually coming back to the thought that, like, oftentimes the things that are not, I'm going to say it wrong before I fix it. The things that are supposed to be will be. And that's not quite what I mean. But what I mean is that, like, think of it if you're I've got young adults. Teenagers growing into adults. And I often think about, you know, what does it look like to try to date or find a fella in these days? And then I think to myself something that I did not believe, I think, when I was younger, and I wish I had. I mean, my life would have been bolder. But it's like, you know, the right type of person will respond to you positively if you try to gain their affections or friendship.
Sure.
But if they act negatively, well, then they're not the right type of person. Oh,
well. Yeah, they've done you a service.
Right. And so, like, that's true for friends. It's true for all kinds, even for work. Like, let's say you want to go apply for a job that, like, you know, is above your grade, but you're going to give it a shot. Like, let's say you don't get it. Okay. Well, either you don't want to work for those people because they dislike you and that's why they didn't choose you. You're not qualified. Well, good. You weren't put into a situation.
Yeah, a crappy situation,
yeah.
Right?
Or you were qualified and for some other goofball reason they didn't choose you. You're like, well, they seem like duplicitous people.
Right.
And so, like,
thankful for every job I didn't get.
Yeah. And so it just, the more I, like, here, it seems very neat and tidy because it feels like nothing can ever go wrong. And it's not true that it can't go wrong, but, like, wrong by what measure? It would seem wrong that you were the best qualified person and didn't get the job, except for the type of people who would not choose you for that reason, you don't want to work for.
Right, exactly.
And so,
yeah, either side of that equation, you are being served.
Right. So it seems too simple, I think. There's a flaw in it somewhere. But, like, I think about this for the wedding. You invited them to the wedding and they didn't come. Yeah. Well, and you think the reason was stupid. Well, isn't it then just fine that they didn't come? Why would you want those type of people at the wedding?
Yeah, sure.
Well, you're obviously not that close to you, or you would have had a conversation.
Right.
Yeah, we sent you a
save
date 6 months ago.
I ordered steak for them. You know, I mean, it's, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, next time you do a wedding, make sure you put how much money it was for each plate as you send the save
send them
dates.
A bill.
Yeah. We're sending you $65 a plate. You should really come.
Yeah. So maybe the broad advice is that, like, go, like, just take chances in life, and for the most part, I think it's going to hold that things are going to work out the way that they should have worked out. You don't have to like it, but I would be cautious about how much time you spend not liking it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because for reasons either outside of your control, they didn't go the way you wanted, or somebody revealed their true colors and, like, okay, now you know about it, so it's too pragmatic, but I do actually think this would work here, and so let it go. Like, just give up being mad at them.
Yeah. And within your marriage, talk to your husband about this. Because apparently you felt so strongly about this that it was just one of your deepest, most viciously held convictions that you were never going to send these cards to these people again. And your husband went, well, she's away. I'm just freaking doing this. Because it meant a lot to him to send them.
Yeah.
Or potentially he's just like, screw her. I'm doing this. Either way,
yeah,
you should probably have some deep conversations with your husband about this and figure this out.
Yeah.
And not approach this as in you're in the right, he's in the wrong. But maybe find some spots to figure out why what happened
yeah,
so that he can get a chance to talk to you about how he felt about it.
Yeah.
And you got to be honest about what a wedding is. Right. I mean, it's really meaningful to you. It's your daughter. It's your, you know, everything. But, like, I went to one of my cousin's weddings. My other ones, I don't remember if I did or not, because I was younger than them. But, I mean, you're taking an entire day at least. You know,
yeah,
it's not like a short thing to just go in there and do this, you know, especially if you're family. You don't just go in, do the ceremony, and head on out.
Right.
So you're it's a considerable amount of time and effort and energy and commitment. And if you're not that close, you're like, you know, I could make money here. I got to make my house payment this month. You know, there's just other things to do. I don't know. Some of the best gifts I've gotten in life have been not been invited to weddings where I'm like, phew, that just opened up my whole weekend. You know, and I'm okay with that. I mean,
you should send them a thank you card, Ben. Oh, I want you to know how much I appreciate you.
And I didn't have to buy you a gift.
I didn't have to lie and show up to this wedding and eat your gross food. Oh gosh, thank you so much.
I mean, this gal's ego is she's just getting too. Yeah. She's really putting too much weight on this thing. It's just life. It's just life.
Yep.
Yep. Agreed.
Let it go.
All right. Secular says, although you didn't want to send holiday cards to the relatives who skipped your daughter's wedding, apparently your husband didn't feel the same way. He was entitled to do what he did. Repeat after me. A wedding invitation is not a command performance. Now let it go.
There you go.
Wow.
Good.
That is not the kind of thing I was expecting to hear from Secular.
That's a surprise.
All right. One more?
Yeah, I'll do one more.
Right. Dear Laugh of the Pan. My boyfriend and I received a generous gift card from my brother and sister-in-law to a restaurant we love. Next week, the four of us are going to dinner together there. My question is about the etiquette of using such a gift card. Should we use it that night or plan not to use it? If we use it and there is excess, should we pay towards my brother's bill? I know my brother won't be bothered or offended either way, but I'm curious about the correct way to handle this, and I'd appreciate your advice.
What?
Just use it like a normal debit
card. Brother and sister-in-law gave girlfriend, boyfriend a gift card to their favorite place. Now all four of them, recipients of the gift card and givers of the gift card, are going to that restaurant next week.
Yeah.
Receiver of the gift card is wondering if they should use that gift card on the meal or if it feels weird to do that because it's a gift that you got from the people.
What do you mean?
And if you have more left over from your dinner, should you apply the rest of the gift card to your brother and sister-in-law's meal? The move?
If and you're apparently, splitting the meals,
the brother will not care.
Yeah, yeah. I cannot tell you with the people I'm with what they use to pay for their meal. I don't care.
Right.
If it is that's a Discover.
Your brother's watching you, or maybe your sister-in-law is watching to see if you use the gift card that they give you.
I don't know. Maybe
you.
Someone else that's gave me a gift card, too.
You should never accept a gift from them again.
Yeah.
Because they're the kind of people who give the gift and go, are they going to use it back on us? Or what are they going to do? That seems weird. How far removed are you from any thoughts in this social situation that this is just flabbergasting you right now?
I'm flabbergasted. I don't understand. Somebody gives me a gift card to McDonald's.
Yes, Mickey D's. And then you're going there next week.
Hey, let's go to Mickey D's next week.
Sure.
What kind of person would go, hey, man, you being lame and using that gift card I gave you at this McDonald's?
To this place that you love, and then which is why we got it for you?
And then goes, hey, bro, did you use all that up? Why don't you help a man out and use that gift card I gave you to help cover some of my meal? Like, this all seems like ridiculous.
Yeah.
Why would you even think that?
Yeah. It seems like, admittedly, it seems like this is the insanity of the person who received the gift card.
Yes.
Because they're even willing to admit that their brother probably won't care about the situation.
Of course they won't.
When I was reading that, I was wondering if it was going to end. My brother probably won't care about this, but my sister-in-law definitely will judge us for this, blah, blah, blah. But it never ended there. It was just, my brother probably won't care about this, but am I thinking this incorrectly? What's the correct way?
Yeah, I would do the exact opposite. If you showed up and started to use cash, I go, dude, why don't you use that gift card we got you?
Right,
You blow through it already.
You idiot.
Yeah, like, what are you doing?
I got you a gift card and then invited you to this place so you could immediately use it so that it wasn't just sitting in your billfold for the next six years. Excuse me. Weird.
Yeah, I don't, You cheap toadstool, I can't believe you used that gift card I got you. I don't understand this at all.
All right.
Go ahead, hit me.
The Secular says, if my mail is any indication, some folks become offended if someone they are splitting the bill with uses a gift card rather than a credit card or cash. That's why it never hurts to ask that question of the person who is joining you before going to the restaurant. It's not even helpful advice. It means nothing.
Oh, just ask the brother? Hey, do you mind if I use this?
Under the perspective that, like, some people don't like it when someone who is splitting the bill with them uses a gift card.
Why?
Who knows?
I could care less how you pay for it.
Okay.
People, stop it. Just stop it. Worry about your own affairs. Stop worrying about everyone else's affairs if this is the way that you're going to worry about their affairs.
Okay.
If you're going to worry about someone else's affairs to go, I hope they have enough cash, maybe I should just cover the bill because I love them. That's a good way to think about things. But if your worry is, oh, they better not use a gift card, you shut your mouth and you change your ways immediately.
Yeah, the only reason I would ask that is so if some doofus that I may go out to dinner with goes, yeah, I'm not really comfortable with that, I would know not to go out to dinner with them.
Yes, never going to dinner with you again. If I have a gift card, I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I've never once thought I shouldn't use a gift card in front of someone because they might judge me. I hope that person judges me, back to the earlier conversation, so that I can then receive the service of me never having to go out to dinner with them again.
What is there to judge? It's not a poverty card.
I don't know. Like, yeah, right, exactly. I'm not using my food stamps on Alaskan King Crab. Like, that's not the situation. Here's the deal. If I see you pull out a food stamp card and I see you buy $39.99 a pound Alaskan King Crab, I'll judge you more for that than you using a gift card to a joint that I bought you the gift card to.
Yeah. Yeah,
what?
This is wrong. You should move to Chile. Chile wants you.
Go to Argentina.
America's had enough. All right, you listen to Live from the Path. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. I very much appreciate it. If you got feedback for us on the show, hit us up on the Live from the Path complaint line, 515-517-0085. Call or text. It's the Bob Eisenlauer Live from the Path complaint line, 515-517-0085. We appreciate any feedback you have from the show. Actually, we heard from our friend Marshall this week, who was digging through the archives. A brave soul.
A brave soul.
Going through the archives.
And hit a landmine that I predicted.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's true. Booba was proven right. Dan had said some Dan type of things in this episode. And Booba had said, someone's going to listen to this and it's going to come up. And it did. Good old Marshall hanging out.
Yeah, and I believe I said at the time that they'll have to make sure they understand it in context or it'll sound much worse.
It's going to sound bad. Yeah, it was the dumpster fire episode, if you want to. If I remember correctly, we were talking about investing in marijuana. Just all kinds of stuff.
That was a wild one.
I remember from then on, I decided I will never run for political office because someone will find that.
That's how you know it was a good episode. Dan's like, I guess I gave up my political career after this one.
Dan's not. Do not elect Dan Hudson. All right. Anyway, thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you. You know, Christmas time and New Year's is dicey. We'll see when the shows come out. Maybe if we're not here, we still got another, I think, 5 years worth of shows that I have to get posted back. And so if we don't do fresh shows, maybe I'll start trying to fill that back catalog. But in the meantime, be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. You've been listening to Live from the Path.